Hello and welcome to Cooper Talks USA. And today I'm going to be looking at pressure groups and lobbying, asking whether or not lobbying is undemocratic or in the national interest. Now, there might be a popular view on this, particularly with what's going on in American politics with guns at the moment. But bear with me, because this is an interesting debate and one that should be well considered, particularly for those of you doing A-level exams. Now, what is lobbying? Lobbying is not about paying for votes. That is corrupt. That is illegal. If you get caught, you go to jail for that. And it's a relatively small problem. It has happened in the past, but generally it doesn't happen in American politics. The Abramoff affair and scandal back in, when was it, 2004? I might have got the year wrong there. But the Abramoff scandal is an example of that. But that is relatively rare. What tends to happen is lobbyists are seeking to influence members of Congress. So lobbying is about gaining access to those in power, either in the legislative branch or the executive branch or even the judicial branch, and trying to persuade them to vote in a particular way, to pass some favourable legislation, or to give an appointment to a government post to a particular person, something like that, or fund a particular project that might help the members. That's what lobbying is about. That's what lobbyists are doing. And one of the reasons that is so common in America is because of the right to petition. It is constitutionally protected. One of the First Amendment has five freedoms, one of which is the right to petition, which means anyone can meet with any member of the government and try to persuade them of something. Now, in 1790s, when this was debated, discussed, and sent out for ratification, it was a radical idea. It was something new. Traditionally, monarchs hadn't listened to ordinary people. They hadn't had the right to meet with their king or their queen and petition them. So this was a new and radical idea designed to promote democracy in America. These days, it isn't seen as so radical and so revolutionary, and is actually seen as undermining democracy, but it also explains why it's so difficult in America to regulate the practice of lobbying, because you can't stop it without a constitutional amendment. And this perhaps explains why various reforms or attempts to restrict lobbying have never been successful. You've also got this situation in America of the absence of class consciousness, and as such a class identity with sort of common and shared beliefs and attitudes. And this means you get a wide variety of contradictory views in some ways. You know, a person sees no contradiction with being part of a pro-life organization and a pro-gun organization. And they will want both of these organizations to succeed and see no contradiction in that. What that means is there is a system of hyper-pluralism. The problem isn't a few elitist pressure groups. The problem is so many Americans are members of so many competing interest groups, all of which are raising and spending money to achieve their aims, that it gives the appearance of corruption and a huge variety of vested interests. There's also the party problem in America. Because the parties are trying to appeal to at least 60 million voters to win a presidential and congressional elections in a country as diverse as America, the parties need to be weak and they need to compromise. You know, the traditional view that both parties essentially support abortion in at least some circumstances. The Democrats support it in most, but not every circumstance. The Republicans, more restrictions, but in certain circumstances, many Republicans will say, go on record and support abortion, usually the case of rape and incest, if not the mother's health. That's a compromise line, whereas interest groups allow their members to campaign without compromising. They don't need to worry about balance. They just get or just champion the cause that they believe in as they believe in it. You also have the problem that America is a continental power. You know, what is there to unify the people of Hawaii with the people of Nebraska, or the people of Maine with the people of Texas? And lobbyists and lobbying can play a vital role in enabling this. The other thing to remember is many of these interest groups and their membership are not particularly active. They go for material benefits, or they join for symbols or for social benefits, you know, anything like that. You know, to join a social club, or people join the AARP to get their discounted car insurance or cheap holidays, things like that. And this isn't really a threat, but there are some interest groups that have very active members who are very keen on putting pressure on those in power. And that's where we get a big problem, when an active minority can basically dominate a passive majority. And that's where we get accusations that lobbyists and pressure groups can undermine the public interest. And most of this, although there might be positive goods there, the influence of interest groups and lobbyists is seen as profoundly negative. Trump campaigned against it, but so did Obama, so did John McCain, so did Romney, so did Hillary, although it was one of the main attacks against Hillary, so did Bush, so did Clinton, Gore. They've all attacked this lobbying culture because most Americans have a very negative view of it, drain the swamp and so on. And they have this negative view because they think it's interest groups, these lobbying firms, that lead to governmental gridlock and laws and public policies and public spending that cater to particularly powerful actors and interest groups rather than acting in the national interest, or at least in the democratic interest. As a result of that, Washington has a poor reputation, and there's some empirical data for this which we'll come to. Now, other things, or the main things that I want to consider in this talk, are what is it that explains the existence of so many interest groups in the USA? I've touched on this already, and their power. I want to think about how influential interest groups and lobbies are in securing their goals. You know, do they always get what they want? And under what conditions do they manage to get what they want? It's also worth considering, are the big groups, the ones that we all know about, the NRA and AIPAC, are they more the exception or the rule when it comes to exerting substantial influence on public policy? And on balance, are they a positive or a negative feature of American democracy? You might think you know the answer, but it's worth looking at it from different points of view. And it's worth considering this. America is a diverse country with diverse interests, and you've got 435 members of the House, you've got 100 senators, and you need at least, even at the basic level, you'd need a majority to pass anything like that. But what is there to get the representatives of New York City and the business interests to support Louisiana sugar planters? Or why should Iowa wheat farmers themselves support Louisiana in anything that it wants? And the answer here is lobbying and the various deals that go on, congressional deals. You know, Louisiana representatives might meet with your New York representatives and say, hey, we'll support this tax break for corporations in New York if you guys vote for subsidies for sugar planters in our constituencies. And that actually enables legislation in a diverse country like America to happen, these sort of backroom deals of self-benefit. It's not pretty, but it can be effective in getting legislation passed. It's a bit like the old maxim on sausages. A lot of people like sausages, but you don't want to see how they're made. The American political system is open. People see how the laws are made. It's certainly not pretty, but when it happens, it can be effective. The problem is that for most Americans, and the media play on this, as do politicians campaigning for national office, the idea is that you have the assumption is that a plethora of interest groups are working for vested interests, and that the average American loses out, particularly the American taxpayer. So what's the conventional wisdom? Well, the conventional wisdom is that America has the best political system money can buy. A few years ago, I read a brilliant book, not necessarily the most academic of books, but certainly well written and well researched, by a journalist called Mark Leibovich, and it was called This Town: Two Parties and a Funeral Plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital. So there you go, a nice snappy title for you. But what Leibovich does is he looks at this negative element, these negative views of lobbying, and he basically argues that lobbying has led to a system of corruption and dysfunction in American politics, and it's created a town in Washington, D.C. that works well for itself and especially its lobbyists. And he looks at the growing power and influence and the wealth of lobbyists, and where those lobbyists have come from and how they've generated their wealth. And there's some empirical data to back that up. four of the five wealthiest counties in America border Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. has no business other than politics. So where's all this money coming from? Why are they so much wealthier than counties in Texas or California or New York? Goes further. Seven of the 10 wealthiest counties in America are near to Washington, D.C. And this is because the lobbyists are buying big houses, the big cars, and the money's coming in, and it's the lobbyists and the vested interests that are benefiting from it, from a town that benefits itself. And this is what politicians have attacked, draining the swamp, the corruption, and the appearance of ineptitude. And that's what Leibovitz emphasizes. He argues that there's this permanent governing class that exists, and he looks at the incumbency rates, the fact that most of the politicians, okay, even if they lose a seat or retire from Congress, stay in Washington, D.C. They go and then work for a lobbying firm, as do many of their staff. You just get these same people changing jobs, whether they're in an elected position or in a private position, but just switching positions, generating wealth for themselves in Washington, D.C., and doing things for their own and for vested interests. And it goes beyond partisanship, because it's both parties working together. It's not about party politics or representation. It's about how much money you can get. And in this sense, Leibovitz argues money has trumped, bad pun, money has trumped power. And the thing that people seek more than anything isn't the presidency. It's not a cabinet position or anything like that. The most coveted thing in Washington, D.C. is a post-government source of income where you can make millions. And that has led to our corruption of the system, where elected members and their staff are more bothered about pleasing people offering them employment after their public service than they are in serving the needs of the public. There's a lot of evidence to back this up with Leibovitz that I've already mentioned. Certainly lobbying has grown over the last few decades. There's a number of reasons for that. First of all, legislation is much longer and much more complicated. Go back to sort of the 1950s, typically the average bill was about 2 or 3 pages in length. Now the average bill is 20 pages long. Big legislation like the Affordable Care Act will be thousands of pages long. Well, maybe not thousands, but it's only 1,000 pages with a lot of amendments. And it's always worth, if you see any signing, if you look back at the Trump tax laws, I can't remember how many pages they were, but if you look at Donald Trump signing it, it's an enormous piece of legislation. It sort of files high. And the problem there is Congress people don't have time to read it. They're too busy raising money to fight the next election, particularly in the House, where they've only got 2 years to fight off a primary challenge or a rival challenge. So they have staff to do that, but their staff don't have that much time either, because they're having to field tweets and arrange meetings and so on. Most of their staff, the average age of congressional staff now is 26, so they don't know anything, they don't have any experience. All this means there is a greater need for interest groups and lobbyists to come around and advise these staff and advise Congress people to do the hard work for them. And that's what allows them to develop their interest. Why read a 20, 30 page bill that you might have to consider in committee when a group might come along or a lobbying firm might come along and say, right, we've read it, summed it up for you. These are the key points you need to know, and this is how we think you should vote. Saves a lot of time and a lot of hassle, but of course gives private interests a deal of influence. In the mid-1950s, just to prove the growth of lobbying, there were 5,000 registered lobbyists. Since 2013, after a peak of about 13,500, there's about more than 12,000 lobbyists registered in Washington, D.C. But on top of that, you've also got thousands of consultants and strategic advisors, which are basically lobbyists by another name. If you're a lobbyist, you have to register and then there's restrictions. But if you're a political consultant or a strategic advisor, you don't, and you're not restricted to those regulations. So it's a rose by any other name here. And with legislators spending 3 of every 5 days raising money to fund their next election campaign, they need to be wary of upsetting a particularly powerful interest group. Again, this is the sort of Leibovitz argument. Those wealthy interest groups donate to campaigns in the expectation they will get preferential treatment or consideration when it comes to voting on legislation. And certainly this is a problem in American politics. You know, if we go back to the 2015 UK general election, 2017 was a bit cheaper, but the entire election for all 650 seats cost about £113 million. Well, the 2012 US election for presidency, the House and the Senate was $6.3 billion. The 2014 midterms, $3.8 billion, and 2016 elections, $6.9 billion. Now, when you've got that much money going into election campaigns, and when Congress people feel they need to raise those sorts of sums to secure their seats and their power, they're desperate for anyone that can donate money to them. And that's why interest groups and wealthy individuals with super PACs and so on are able to buy and purchase influence. That goes back to the major criticism. And it's worth bearing in mind, you know, does this have an effect on anything? Well, you could argue, well, why do lobbying firms, why do private interests, why do they pay if it doesn't make any difference? You know, anyone can make a mistake, but why do they keep doing it? Why do we have this interest? But it's worth considering. If we've got two majorly polarized parties, as we commonly think we do, if you've got this massive partisan divide between the Democrats and the Republicans, that they don't agree on anything, why does foreign policy not change for America? Because it doesn't. During the Cold War, you know, the Vietnam War and so on, didn't matter if it was the Democrats or the Republicans, the Vietnam War went on. You look at the War on Terror, okay, there were slight differences at the margins, but by and large, Obama carried on the War on Terror in the same vein that Bush had. Policies towards Israel, they don't change whether it's Democrat or Republican in power. America remains a pro-Israeli country. And you can argue this is the influence of interest groups. Same with guns. You know, the Democrats, you know, obviously you could argue there's been a rise of mass shooting, but you know, 2009 to 2011, the Democrats had control over both chambers of Congress and the presidency. They didn't do anything to introduce gun regulations or gun control, and certainly nothing substantial. Why is that? And you can argue it's the role of lobbyists who are making sure things stay constant, and it's not about party ideology or party goals anymore. And that's why substantive issues in America really don't tend to change. In order to have power, to offer interest groups influence, you need your team to win. So you need your team to be successful. But then policies don't change. People are, in the partisan era of party politics in America, it's just about your team winning, but actually they don't really do anything different when they do win. So that's why in America, although you do get changes of government, mostly there's very little that changes in terms of the day-to-day running of the country. There might be differences over content, but nothing substantial. And this leads to the Leibovitz idea that there's a permanent governing class that transcends Congress and the White House, these people who just live there permanently, and you get the same political advisors coming in and going, members of Congress, leave Congress, go and work for a lobbying firm, or go and work for an interest group, or get a job working in the federal bureaucracy, and they just all live in Washington promoting policies and helping each other out. And yes, publicly they do the big fight, oh, I hate the Democrats, oh, I hate the Republicans, I hope my team win, but actually it doesn't really matter. They're all in there to help themselves as Washingtonians, not as partisan hacks. And of course we've also got the suggestion that lobbying has grown with the range of trips, the growth of lobbying, the plethora of former members of Congress or executive employees who go to work for lobbying firms. All of this suggests it does work, because if it wasn't working, they wouldn't be doing it. And for this reason, it's always worth following the money. Good journalistic trait there, always follow the money. Because money doesn't buy votes, but it does buy influence. And you can see who's got political power by where the money's going. And it's worth bearing in mind that during, if you look at where business money was going over the last few decades, up until 94, business groups tended to give about as much money to Democrats as they would Republicans. Now, from a from an ideological point of view, you would assume party groups and business groups and business interests would want the Republicans in power because the Republicans are pro-business. And yet the money was about equal for the two parties because they were more bothered about the person and if the person was in power rather than any given ideology. Now, from 94 to 2006, the Republicans typically received about 60% of funding from business groups, the Democrats about 40%. That shouldn't be a surprise. The Republicans had control over Congress during that period, although not total control, so you still had to support the Democrats. But 2006, that switches, and suddenly Democrats are getting more money from the business groups. What changes? It's not ideology. In 2006, Democrats won back control over the House and the Senate. They were in power. The money followed the power. 2010, the gap closes up again. It becomes equal. Why? Because the Republicans control the House, the Democrats control the Senate. So they need both parties. The point of this is, it's not about ideology. It's about influencing those in power. And it's very effective. Now, if you go back to the State of the Union address in 2014, just after the Sandy Hook shootings, Obama pleading with Congress to pass some tougher gun control regulation to restrict assault weapons in America. There's lots of cheering, lots of applause and all of that. And then absolutely nothing happened. And the reason for that was the NRA got involved. And why was that? Well, the NRA has 4 million members. No, it doesn't. It has about 7 million members now, spread across all 50 states. It funds 70 full-time lobbyists. So as soon as Obama made that speech, those lobbyists were out there on the phone, sending emails, arranging meetings, going to meet with members of Congress saying, do not support anything, do not propose this, trying to get it killed in committee, building up votes to filibuster in the Senate, all those sorts of things. But also they galvanized those 7 million members to start contacting their congressman and woman, men and women, to try and make sure that they wouldn't back this. And this is why no substantial gun regulation has occurred in America, despite the rise of mass shootings and popular calls for it to happen. You can argue here that on the basis that since the 1960s, I think actually since the 1950s, all opinion polls have showed that two-thirds of Americans favour tougher gun regulation. And yet nothing's happened. And that would seem to indicate the NRA is having a negative interest, negative impact on the public interest. Most people want tougher gun regulation, yet gun regulation isn't happening because the NRA is able to manipulate and influence Congress. And part of the reason for that is there's nothing equal on the other side. The NRA dominates the debate. What pressure groups there are that campaign for greater gun regulation are quite small. They don't have the funding, they don't have the lobbying resources, they don't have the widespread membership. So the NRA is manipulating Congress, you can argue. But then again, the NRA is successful because it has this widespread membership. And if most Americans didn't support the principle of gun ownership, would Congress people be worried about being attacked by the NRA? The answer is no. The NRA has power because it threatens to campaign against Congress people that are seen as anti-guns, of giving them low ratings and so on. That gives them power and influence. But that wouldn't matter unless it mattered to the voters of their constituents. So in that sense, the NRA is able to influence Congress, not because of vested interest, but because most Americans, though they might like tougher gun control, are pro-guns. In the same way, you could argue, why is America is a capitalist system? Why do businesses do well in a capitalist system? Because it's a capitalist system. Why does the NRA do so well in America? Because Americans have a big gun culture. That's why there's so few gun. Well, there are actually lots of gun regulations, but in terms of restrictions, there are relatively few. You could also look at AIPAC. Now, AIPAC, a lot of people assume it's supported mostly by Jews. That's not actually true. It's mostly supported by evangelical Christians, and there's a lot of those in America. And so, again, there's a degree of popular support. But it's worth considering, yes, AIPAC's powerful. Yes, AIPAC does try and promote a very, very pro-Israeli government policy. And obviously, they were involved in influencing Trump to declare Jerusalem the capital of Israel, to recognize that. But in the decades before that, whether it was a Democrat or a Republican, no president had bothered to recognize that. But if we assume AIPAC as being successful, it's because it has because it has a lot of members spread across America. But equally, it's worth asking, if AIPAC didn't exist, would America or American policy towards Israel be substantially different? And I suspect the answer is no. I mean, maybe at the margins, perhaps, but Israel is still seen as a sort of westernized democratic state. The role in the Cold War, all those sorts of things, obviously the war on terror and Israel's position. I'm not sure American policy towards Israel would be that different if AIPAC didn't exist. So it's clearly powerful, but that doesn't explain where it got its power from. And that's the problem with this traditional criticism and the Leibovitz argument. Leibovitz takes the power, takes the politics out of politics. And that's what it's all about. It's all about power struggles and looking at how influential the pressure groups and the parties are in those various power struggles. Just to add a little bit more to this, most business groups, most single issue groups like the NRA and so on, if you look at where their money goes to, it goes to incumbents. So again, it's not partisan. They're not trying to get a Democrat majority or a Republican majority. They're looking to gain influence with members in power. Now, if you've got an incumbent who you know has won, we know in America, because of gerrymandering, because of partisan loyalty and so on, incumbents have a high success rate. So you know they're more likely to retain their seat. There's only about 29 genuinely competitive House seats. So you back the incumbent because you know they're quite likely to still be in Congress. And of course, incumbents have experience, which means they get the seniority rule. They have higher positions on committees and committee chairs, which makes them more influential. So it's not partisan. It's about getting influence, and you get influence by backing incumbents, not about removing them. It's about getting the ability to access them. And that's what you want. You want the congressman or woman to take your phone call or to allow you a meeting. That's what you donate money for, and that's what you're campaigning for. Now, if we evaluate the US interest group, what explains the existence of so many interest groups in the USA? Well, the first one is the diversity of interests. We'll mention it with the sugar planters of Louisiana. What on earth do the people of Louisiana have in common with the people of Maine, or the people of Hawaii with the people of Texas, and so on? It's a diverse and disparate country of 330 million people from a range of ethnic and religious and cultural backgrounds. And as such, they all want their interests and their views to be represented. And that's why we have so many interest groups all competing to be heard. There's a lack of class consciousness, which means there's a lack of cohesion generally across America. You know, working class people of New York have very different views and priorities from working class people of Detroit or working class people of Little Rock, Arkansas. So because of that, interest groups tend to cut across class divisions or other divisions, and people will champion their cause even if it doesn't really make sense. Classic example of this is the sort of poor black guy from New York, who you would assume, New York City, who you'd assume would be voting Democrat but might vote Republican because or might support a pro-life group because of his particular Christian convictions. It doesn't seem to make sense, but they see no contradiction or no anomaly in that. You can be a poor black minority living in New York and still support a potentially conservative interest group if that reflects your belief. You've also got the interest, the fact that government has grown markedly in America since the 1930s. With the New Deal programs, the Great Society programs, and so on, government now does more. There's more government agencies, there's more areas in which the government legislates and influences the public. As a result, the government does more, therefore there are more things to lobby for. There's more positions to lobby for, there's more areas the government's involved in, there's more grants that can be given, more federal expenditure. And that has led to the growth of interest groups and the growth of lobbying since the 1930s. And that partly explains why lobbying has grown and the vested interest and money in Washington DC has grown. You've also got in America the nature of the political system. America is a federal system with clear separation of powers. If you want to achieve something, you can go to Congress, or you can go to the executive branch, or you can go to the judiciary, or you can actually start targeting one or many of the individual states. So there's many more opportunities to influence seriously and substantially influence the political process. In the UK, realistically, if you want to make a big difference, you need to target Westminster, and within that, the House of Commons, and within that, the government. You need to persuade the Prime Minister and the Cabinet to back you, otherwise it's not going to happen. In the USA, actually, you can persuade a few senators and actually prevent something from happening, or you can persuade a state legislature, as happened with gay marriage issues, to change the constitution, the state constitution, to define marriages between a man and a woman. And there you go. Now you've got a case for trying to deny gay marriage, which is what was at issue in the Obergefell case. Or, slightly earlier, states like Massachusetts, which said, well, we're going to recognise gay marriage. You can start by targeting the states to try and build up political pressure on the federal government. So the range of access point also explains the interest group universe of America and why it's so diverse and seemingly so prevalent. But how influential are those interest groups? Are they always successful? We can look at the NRA and say clearly the failure to enact gun regulation, despite public commands, despite the outrage with all the mass shootings that happen, show that pressure groups are successful. Look at America's policy towards Israel. AIPAC is clearly influential. Look at look at the AARP. Social Security and Medicaid funding for the elderly doesn't get cut. Trump said he's not going to cut that. And yet, Medicaid and Social Security funding, welfare funding, makes up a far bigger proportion of the American budget than defense spending. If you're not going to cut those programs, you're going to struggle to make any cuts to the American deficit. And that's what Republicans say they want to do, and yet it doesn't happen. Arguably because of the importance and power of the AARP. But those are largely exceptional because there's no countervailing force to it. And it's also worth bearing in mind that those pressure groups aren't always successful. A number of American states have introduced gun regulation. There are actually 27,000 gun laws across America at the moment. Now, some of them are quite minor, and most of them are done at the state level, but the NRA's objected to them all, but they still happen. The NRA's had to make some concessions, and other states have just passed tougher gun restrictions anyway, particularly places like Washington and New Jersey. So the NRA doesn't always get what it wants, nor does AIPAC. Obama, when was it, about 2014, Obama gave $60 million of military hardware to Gulf states. Now, AIPAC lobbied to stop that from happening, but in the end, Obama ignored them because geopolitical concerns to fight global terrorism trumps lobbying money from AIPAC. Equally, until Trump, no one had listened to AIPAC in terms of moving the capital or recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. The reason being, it would just create a huge international political problem. Trump doesn't mind that, but Trump is the exception. Before that, Democrat or Republican, they ignored AIPAC's demands. So they don't always get what they want. But if they are going to be successful, there are four criteria that need to be met. The first is, the interest group universe needs to be asymmetrical. So with the NRA, AIPAC, the AARP, they tend to be more successful because there is no strong countervailing force against them. Anti-gun groups, those that exist, they tend not to be very well organized, tend not to be well funded or well supported. The pro-Palestinian groups in America, certainly not popular, very small, don't have the resources, don't have the popular support, certainly not after they were seen celebrating the 9/11 attacks. That definitely didn't do them any favors. And of course, various youth groups, but there aren't really any major youth groups that are organized. Certainly nothing that can compete with the AARP. So that's one of the things that allows these groups to be successful. The other thing, the second factor, is if groups possess a mass membership, ideally dispersed across a number, if not all, congressional constituencies, or if they've got substantial resources. So again, the NRA tends to be successful, not necessarily because of the money, but because it's got 7 million active members within, spread across America. There's at least one in every congressional district ready to go to challenge any gun restriction laws that are proposed. The AIPAC doesn't have the same level of popular support, but it does have the financial clout and financial resources to hire lots of lobbyists to organize fact-finding missions and to help influence politicians. So those resources can help an interest group to achieve their goals. But remember, it can only buy access, it can't persuade on its own. Okay, so you can only, you know, all these things can only help you to try and influence. It doesn't mean the congressperson will actually do what you want. The third factor that leads to group success is if the group can build a broad political coalition. We know how difficult it is to get things done in American politics. You need to try and be able to build a coalition between Democrats and Republicans. Actually, it's relatively rare that we have unified government with both chambers of Congress and the presidency held by the same party. So you're going to need to influence both. But even in the Senate, you know, with the use of filibusters, you'll usually need some Democrats to come on side with the Republicans if the Republicans are in the majority. So, and of course, we've got in the House at the moment, the Freedom Caucus causes problems, so it's difficult to get things passed. Either you need to link to them or you need to persuade Democrats to work with Republicans. So you need to be able to build a broad cross-party coalition to get things done. And the fourth factor that leads to group success is if the group is more concerned about vetoing rather than advancing policy change. This is because in America, the legislative process has an inbuilt negative bias. It's far easier to stop something from happening than to create it. Now, in the legislative process, there's about 13 moments where a piece of legislation can be defeated. It could die in committee, could lose a floor vote. Well, you've got both chambers, you've got the conference committee, and of course you've got the presidential signing, all of which can lead to the end of a bill. So to be successful, a piece of legislation has to jump over every single one of those hurdles. But to stop a bill from happening, you just need to be successful once. And that makes it far easier to block things. And we saw that most noticeably in 2017 with the Republicans' attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which can only be done through legislation. Got it through the House, tried to get it through the Senate, and they lost, because a couple of Republicans voted with the Democrats, notably John McCain. Why was that? You could argue because lobbyists were in there, insurance companies, business interests, as well as healthcare and welfare groups, saying you can't scrap it without something else to replace it, otherwise things are going to go chaotic. And they persuaded members of Congress to block the legislation. And it worked. In order to pass any new legislation, it's got to overcome every single one of those hurdles. So if you want to stop something, it's far easier in America than if you're a pressure group that wants to create something. And that, again, is why the NRA is relatively successful. It's trying to stop new laws being imposed on guns, which is far easier to block, which is far easier to do than groups that want to create new laws that would put restrictions on guns. Of course, in 2010, with the passage of the Affordable Care Act, this took nearly 2 years, even with combined majorities, for the Democrats to pass, showing just how difficult it is to create new legislation. So if you're a pressure group that supports blocking something like the NRA, it's much easier than if you're a pressure group that's seeking to create a new policy or a new initiative. And to be honest, the only time that the American federal government has had a major policy reversal was prohibition. It doesn't happen that often. It's the only time it's actually changed its mind on something. Usually, as long as you want to go with the flow, it's much easier. It's also worth bearing in mind, for this reason, the government hasn't shrunk. The only thing Republicans like Bush or Reagan have managed to do is reduce the rate at which government grows. And that's because interest groups have got involved with the lobbying. Now, are groups like the National Rifle Association and AIPAC and the AARP the exception rather than the rule? The answer is yes. Okay, they are exceptions. We talk about them a lot in politics because they're exceptional. That's what makes them interest. But actually, the vast majority of interest groups have countervailing forces, pro-life versus pro-choice, pro-gay or gay rights groups versus the Christian right, environmental groups versus big business or sort of oil companies and so on. There are countervailing forces. And while lobbyists can get influence and try and persuade members of Congress, there's someone else trying to persuade them and trying to influence them. And Congress people, and as long as they don't just go with the last person to speak to them, have to consider a range of issues. So this is actually an example of pluralism. And we usually regard pluralism as the high point of democracy. Different groups representing different interests and a neutral government making a decision based on the evidence. That is the very model of pluralism. So in that sense, lobbying and lobbying activity is a positive feature of American democracy. It makes America a pluralist democracy. The problem is when you have those exceptional pressure groups, either because there's no countervailing force or because they're able to dominate the debate through their financial resources or their, the financial resources more than anything, creates a sense of elitism. But actually, those situations are relatively rare. So you could argue that lobbying is a sign of a healthy American democracy. So, what are the good and the bad points? Well, let's look at the positive ledger for interest groups and lobbying in America. There are five positive functions: representation, participation, public education, agenda building, and oversight program monitoring. Okay, those are the five main positives of interest group and lobbying activity. They provide a means of representation across different groups, largely making up for the deficit of the parties. They give citizens a chance to participate in the public political process through marches, campaigns, social activities, and so on. They campaign. They put adverts out there. They commission reports and research to educate the public. They build agendas and build coalitions to achieve desired outcomes. And of course, they oversee what Congress people are doing. That's where the rating system comes in. So they provide oversight to make sure Congressmen and women are voting as their constituents would like. All of that's quite a good thing. And just to defend this, it's worth bearing in mind, Americans say they dislike special interests. Okay, they say, oh, we hate special interests, we hate the lobbying culture. Unless that special interest is defending their own favoured priorities and preferences. So a bit like people say they hate their MP, they hate Westminster, or they hate Congress, but they like their MP or they like their representative. People hate all interest groups are terrible. But if you support gun rights, the NRA is doing an amazing job. People hate interest groups, but if you are environmental, you love the Sierra Club. No, that's doing a fantastic job. That should have more power and influence. So again, you've got to take it with a bit of a pinch of salt. You know, most Americans only dislike interest groups if the interest groups are working against their desired outcome. It's also worth bearing in mind, a lot of things you might perceive as positive changes have come through through interest group coordination and lobbying. Civil rights legislation in the 60s came about as a result of interest groups lobbying and persuading the government. If you support it, then same-sex marriage is a positive good that's come through pressure group campaigning. Reproductive rights for women, abortion rights, environmental laws, all of that probably wouldn't have happened had you not had the accompanying active interest groups lobbying from the grassroots to state, to federal laws, bringing Supreme Court cases, funding election campaigns, and so on. It's just a question of, do you support the changes or not? The empirical evidence is, to be honest, lacking with regards to influence versus access. You know, we can assume it does, but there's no proof that pressure groups with more lobbying or more access actually influence groups more than anything. You can't really say there's a graph that proves 50 hours of lobbying equals a successful outcome. There's no data to back that up. But of course, while it's lacking, why else are they doing it? They're doing it because it works. Okay, it might not be provable, but that's why they're doing it. And of course, unelected lobbies and policy inertia and diplomacy or new gun control laws, we can look at all that and say, well, hang on, do we really support that? Has that all come through unelected lobbies? Is it really that positive? And how do they go about buying politician lawmakers' decisions? And what about legislative activity influences? You know, a lot of these are accused of being undemocratic or negative, but actually it's about linking the representative to the constituents. The NRA ratings only matter if the constituents of that representative care about guns. Being on the Dirty Dozen list only matters if the constituents are going to be bothered about it. So it depends what the local population want. When it's easy to say that lobbyists are trying to buy politicians' votes, certainly trying to influence their decision making, but they're only one of a number of factors. So the constituency and the folks back home, that's a big one. You know, if you're from a predominantly black constituency, you're certainly not going to vote against their interests, because you'll lose your seat if you do. Lawmakers have their own personal beliefs. Lobbying might try and influence them, but if they don't support the lobbying group, they're not going to vote for it. You've got the preferences of party leaders. You know, we've seen a rise of partisanship. What Pelosi or Ryan or Dick Durbin, Chuck Schumer, sorry, Chuck Schumer more than Dick Durbin. Well, no, Dick Durbin more than Chuck Schumer. But anyway, those two and Mitch McConnell, what they say and what the president says, that probably matters more than lobbying, you could argue. You've got the interest of the lawmaker states in general. You've got other officials, you know, what governors say, the state governor, what the president says. Presidential lobbying can be just as powerful, if not more so. You've got the role of the bureaucracy and how they're influencing and whether the money's actually there. You might say, well, actually, the lawmakers already supported this because of their own beliefs. They've got a history of supporting environmental policies or gun laws. So it's not lobbying that makes a difference. This is what the guy votes for. He's going to remain consistent, or she is. And of course, there's countervailing forces. So to say that lobbying firms are able to just buy their votes is counterintuitive. There are many, many factors, and lobbying is just one factor, and there's no proof that it is the dominant factor. What about the negative ledger then? Okay, what's on the negative side? Well, you get things like iron triangles. Okay, iron triangles and these sort of discrete policy constituencies, which basically exclude ordinary Americans and the interests of ordinary Americans from the political process, as iron triangles work to serve their own self-interest. That's clearly a negative of this lobbying culture and pressure group activity. You certainly get unequal results. You know, in the dollarocracy, political liberty tends to trump political equality. So things that comply or support freedoms defined in the Constitution or have well-backed money tend to benefit, or business groups tend to benefit for themselves, rather than policies that will promote genuine political equality. People want power, they want interest, and so campaign finance laws aren't going to succeed. But laws to enable benefit, tax reform, tax codes, are going to succeed. So you do get unequal results. And again, you could go back to AIPAC, the NRA, and things like that. You could argue that actually interest groups do prioritize some interests over others, and that creates unequal results. You've got a huge number of exemptions in any American law, earmarks and so on, And it's certainly going to be very difficult to remove all money from American politics. You know, it's all pervasive, partly because of the Citizens United ruling, but there's an ingrained culture. This is how American politics work. And it's going to be very, very difficult to change. You see the problems in trying to reform the tax code in America. While Donald Trump's tax law reforms have cut taxes, actually the code is just as complicated, if not more so, than ever before. And as such, people are going to campaign to get their own exemptions. Things would be better, or you could restrict the influence of money in elections by having tougher laws on tax codes and by removing various exemptions, simplifying the tax code right down, or even maybe taking it out of the politicians' hands. I don't know. But that's not going to happen, because in the current system, people benefit, and those are the people that benefit are those that are in charge of keeping the system the same. You could make put limits on revolving door syndrome. They tried with the Honest Leadership and Open Government Act to make sure people couldn't go there. It didn't work. People just found loopholes and ways around it. They just delayed for 6 months. And that's because it's prevalent in American politics. So you get this revolving door syndrome, which means that any expertise in politics or in the federal bureaucracy is lost straight away, making the government more dependent on these interest groups, which in turn gives these interest groups more ability to influence politics. So the revolving door syndrome is a massive problem in American politics. You've also had the normalization of influence peddling. It's how Washington works now. It's become ingrained in the culture. And if you were to remove it in one fell swoop, no one would be able to get anything done. Not that they get much done now these days. But there is a problem, because that routine or normalization of influence peddling is what is alienating the American public. And it's creating this anti-government cynicism that Donald Trump was certainly able to exploit. It's creating a serious lack of trust and confidence in political institutions. And basically, it's causing Americans to despise the politicians and their national capital. And that can create a dysfunctional political system, which arguably is what Donald Trump exploited to get into power, and what is causing gridlock and problems in American politics. So, conclusions. Okay, just to round this off. First of all, defining what is the national interest and what is democratic are not straightforward ideas. And you should always be careful when saying, well, this goes against the national interest, goes against the democratic will of the people, because that's never a clear thing. But hyperpluralism and the extensive role of money and the power of lobbyists does pose serious challenges to the integrity, stability and longevity of the US political system. The real problems, I would say, aren't the NRA, aren't AIPAC, or aren't the AARP. They're exceptions, okay? They can be explained. The problem is actually what goes on under the radar, the stuff that we don't see, the stuff that isn't reported as much, all those tax breaks that are written into legislation, the various corporate exemptions, the subsidies that are given to corporate interest groups. And they get written into law, and laws that aren't actually being read by the lawmakers, that are kind of going through on a nod. That's what's causing the problems. That and the normalization of influence peddling, which is leading to cynicism, that's what's causing the major problems. It's the undercurrent. So it's not the big picture things like the NRA. It's this routine pork barrel politics. What can I get for my constituents? Or more often, what can I get for the vested interest that has just lobbied me? Obama said, you go to Washington to change it or it changes you. Well, after 8 years, I'm afraid it looks like it changed Obama. Trump said he was going there to reform it. He's made no effort or no attempt to reform the lobbying system. If anything, he seems to have benefited from it. And certainly the Republicans and the Tea Party have as well. Now it's the Freedom Caucus. So that's pretty negative. But to just finish on a positive note, it's worth thinking about, okay, well, this is all bad in America. This is terrible. The whole system is corrupt. But actually, is America that bad? comparatively, it's probably cleaner or more rational, certainly less gridlocked, than many other countries. Is the American political system really that much more corrupt than the Italian system or the Spanish system or Indian democracy, or even Australian democracy, Korean democracy, South Korean, not North, Russian democracy, Japanese democracy, even, dare I say it, UK democracy? The difference isn't so much in the practices, but in America it's known about. And it's perhaps done on a larger scale. But in many ways, actually the system is more regulated and more transparent in America than it is elsewhere. For that reason, we see how the sausages are made, and it's not appetizing. But that's the difference. And on that note, thank you very much for listening to this one. I hope it's been useful and giving you some understanding about the role of pressure groups and lobbying in America. If you are doing A-level politics, it should give you the context, the American contextualization of politics, which is very different from the British political system, certainly in the way we study it. Thank you for listening, and I hope to do another one of these fairly soon.